It's a perfect opportunity to come out the other side and go, look, we're not racing our competition to get the prices as low as we can get and to the bottom and do quantity over quality. We're going, this is a quality product. We're using local suppliers. We're using good staff that we're paying properly and we're investing in. And this is the cost that it is to get your food on the plate.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. As we grow up, we look back at meals, at occasions, with fond memories. Dishes passed down through generations, home cooking, gathering around the family table and connecting through food. Food has a wonderful way of creating lasting memories, but how do you replicate those moments in a restaurant setting and give people a sense of nostalgia? Tommy Prosser is the executive chef at Berrima Vault House. Tommy, how are you going?
Yeah, good, thanks, Huck. How are you?
Good. You've done many things in your career, but at the moment you're sort of going back in time and delivering a bit of nostalgia for guests. What's it like trying to do that in a restaurant setting?
Look, it's obviously got its challenges, you know. Like, I was born in England, started washing up when I was 13, and now I'm obviously stuck in Australia, you know, like a lot of expats are. So it's nice to get back and try and channel those memories and those flavors that I had growing up, and to be able to share that with the Australians, the locals, and people that are far away from home. So yeah, it's an interesting challenge, but I think if you channel enough of those memories and feelings yourself into your food, then it comes out the other side.
Well, tell us a bit about those memories. What are some of the dishes that you're creating? And take us back to when you were young to those dishes and why they're so important.
Look, so on the menu, we've got a prawn cocktail, which is something that was quite popular growing up in England and obviously a lot more popular in the 80s, 70s and 80s, early 90s. Now you can't really find them anywhere. They're sort of one of those dishes that have gone into the it's an old dish, you know. People don't find it interesting. For myself, I could eat it breakfast, lunch and dinner. I'm a big fan of those flavors. So I've obviously spent a lot of time coming up with the recipes that remind me and hit those receptors in my brain that lets you go back in time. You put that spoon in your mouth and you can close your eyes and you could be back at the first time that you tried it, you know, surrounded by your family and loved ones, and you open your eyes and you're in the Vault House, which is a 1844 building. It's a fun challenge.
What sort of response have you had from guests as you take that dive into your past and translate it for them on the table?
Well, we had about a month ago, we had a couple in the restaurant and we had a roast, shared roast dinner, and then the dessert was a jam roly-poly with custard made with the suet pastry, local jam. And one of the girls at the table actually started crying because she missed her family and missed the family in England, you know. So the waiter came up and they go, the girl's crying. I went, oh, it's not that bad, is it? They go, no, it's because it's stirred up the memories. So there's been a fair bit of that at the moment already, you know, which is great. We're only 2 months old. And that's the challenge that I've sort of undertaken with this role.
Take us back to the UK when you were young. When did you first start getting interested in food?
My family, my dad loves cooking, loves experimenting, doesn't usually like a recipe. He'll chuck a load of stuff in the pan and usually comes out pretty good. And mum's an avid baker of sourdough and cakes and that kind of stuff now. So growing up, dad's mum used to supply the local pubs and restaurants and things with cakes that she'd make. So I was kind of always surrounded by it. And then when I was 13, I started washing up at the local pub, covering for my brother on the weekends, went from there to college, after that, one Michelin star restaurant, Grave Tie Manor, which was had alumni like Darren Robertson, Phil Vickery, Marcus Raring, all sort of did some time through there. The head chef was Mark Raffan, and he was one of the owners. It was on 1,000 acres, 18th century manor house, one acre kitchen garden, which was walled off to keep all the rabbits out. So I was quite lucky there, you know. We had a gameskeeper that would come in once a month with a couple of deer over his shoulder, so I got exposed to breaking those down there. Made 5 different types of bread, and I was there for about 2 years, so I was lucky enough to work every section. I was on pastry for about 2 months with the pastry chef, and then he quit. So I was running pastry for about 7 months at 19 in a one Michelin star restaurant, coming up with the specials, doing the research. A week into my...
What was that like as a young chef, given so much obligation and to come up with something like that at a young age?
I always kind of took it in my stride, you know. Like, I'm a proud Englishman. I've never really liked asking for help. It's always the stiff upper lip. You sort of grit down and bear it, you know, and just work through. So I relished the challenge. I'd been on the veg section for about 6 months, where obviously you're doing what the main course and the fish chef all want to do. They go, this is what we're doing. So to be able to release some of that creativity and do some research and execute it, it was fantastic, you know. It was a bit of freedom that you never usually get, and not a lot of people get to have at that young age, you know. So it was kind of swings and roundabouts. Like, I was never, because I was quite capable, I was never really put underneath anyone to learn directly and have anyone mentoring. But then you get like this self-starter attitude where you've got to go learn and be proactive and find your own way, you know, underneath the guidelines of what is expected off the menu.
What sort of food were you cooking at that time? Do you have a dish that you remember that you can tell us about from then?
Yeah, look, one of my ones that I was really happy with that I came up with on the pastry was a wild strawberry bavoise that I made with a chocolate sponge underneath. So I grated the chocolate through a genoise, made a wild strawberry bavoise, made a wild strawberry coulis as well, and then a champagne and strawberry jelly on top. So it was nice. It was different. And then obviously some little strawberry crisps for a bit more texture. So I enjoyed it. And we were exposed to like some of the best ingredients around. I know we've got pretty good strawberries in England, but we were getting strawberries from this specific region in France, and they were coming over on a wooden tray. So it's kind of like, yeah, it was very, very different. But the wild strawberries were from the garden. So I was always a bit questioning why we were getting some of those overseas things when we had such amazing produce in our own backyard, you know? But yeah, I was very fortunate and very, very lucky that they put trust in me to be able to execute that, you know? And then when I was 1 week in, for example, the sous chef and the chef de partie on the veg section got into a little scuffle and dislocated the veg chef's shoulder on a Friday night. So he took him to hospital, and I was left to run the section on a 60 cover Friday night in my first week. Like, oh, okay. So it's just little things like that where you either sink or swim, and fortunately I was had enough going for me that I could swim. Yeah, it's interesting.
You ended up at the Waterside Inn, a 3 Michelin star legendary restaurant. How did that gig come about?
Look, so I always wanted to work at the best, you know. So I knew there was a step that I needed to take in my career, different levels and different grades that I needed to do. But if you're going to do something, you want to do it the best that you can do, right? So when I was at Gravetide, Mark had worked for the Roux brothers at the Gavroche just after Marco had been there. And I was getting a little bit itchy and wanted to move on and see some other stuff, and ended up doing a 2-week stage at the Waterside Inn. After that, I thought it was amazing. Came back, came up with some specials at Gravetye, and I just didn't really feel like there was much more room to grow there, you know. So I handed my notice in. He goes, "Where are you going?" I go, "Oh, I don't know yet. I'm going to take some time and maybe go to the Waterside." He's like, "You haven't got a job and you're leaving." He goes, "That's you're not doing that, aren't you?" "Okay," he goes, you email Chef Allen and see if you can get a job." So anyway, I went downstairs to the computer, sent off an email to Chef, and said I really enjoyed my time. And anyway, he's come back about a week later and said, "Yeah, we'd love to offer you a job. When can you start?" And I started there when I was 20. So I was did 3 days on the herb section. They had a herb section at the Waterside where you pick herbs, chop tomato concasse, chop all the herbs, and do the julienne of the veg for the tronçonnette of lobster, which is one of the signature dishes from Michel Roux. I think pretty close to when they first opened. They had a white port sauce and amazing, amazing pan-fried lobster. So I did 3 days on that section and then got moved over to the front fish. So I was ending up cooking all the fish, doing the sauces and helping prepare where I needed to, which was fantastic. So I was fortunate enough to work there in the original kitchen. Spent 9 months on the front fish section. Then there was a £2.5 million refurb of the kitchen, and about five of us got asked to stay behind and cook while they were doing the refurb for different functions and different small gatherings from the little satellite kitchen. And then I was part of the reopening team as well. From there, I was on the front fish for that reopening and then moved to the butchery, which is something that I always had an interest in, like in between Gravetye and the Waterside. I went and worked at Butcher. The two guys had like 150 years of experience between them, you know. One was 80 and been butchering since he was 13, and the other one was 70 and been butchering for about the same amount of time, you know. So I always sort of seeked out those ones. When I was 15, I went to the local butcher and found out how to tie meat. Went to the local fishmonger before one of my competitions at college and learned how to shuck scallops so I could go do that on the competition day, you know. Just spent the whole day shucking scallops and learning how the producers do stuff, because it was always very important to me to see stuff from the purest raw form to that finished part on the plate, you know, and knowing the providence of it. So I was very proactive and very kind of keen to learn every aspect of it. And I could have very easily seen myself being a butcher and running those. So when I got onto the butchery section of the Waterside, it was like I'd struck gold, you know. We'd get the whole magrets in from France with the foie gras still in them. The ducks would come in. You'd have to pluck those. You'd get a whole heap of different game birds, teal, pheasant, partridge, and they'd come in with all their feathers on, and you'd pluck those all down. Woodcocks, you'd cook them whole because they excrete when they take off. You make a pate out of all the innards. There's nothing in there that's bad, you know. And we were making a pate to order. So each woodcock that got roasted off, chop up all the innards with the foie gras, put that on the crouton, and gratinate that under the grill. So it was fantastic at the Waterside, you know. The learning curve was really steep, and you either sank or swam. And again, I was put on to run those sections straight away. Michel Roux would come in after shooting five pheasants at 5:30 p.m. on a Friday night and go, "I need these prepped for my dinner." And you go, "Oh, yeah, okay, chef." You can't say no. And they're whole. They've got the feathers. You've got to quarter them. You've got to pluck them, bar them with fat on the outside, and then vacuum pack them so he can take them away. And you're there trying to prep up for 130 covers on a three Michelin star dinner. So, yeah, look, and there we were exposed to the best ingredients in the world, the milk-fed lamb from the Pyrenees as well. We'd break those down, whole suckling pigs, sides of veal, foie gras terrines, all that kind of stuff. So it was hard. It was a nice kitchen, but it was a hard kitchen, you know, and obviously lots of pressure. So I was never sort of given the tools to deal with that pressure. So I did end up getting a bit burnt out by the end of my year and a half there, sort of on your 18-hour days and doing what you need to do to get through. So I didn't deal with it in the best ways, you know. It was an old school upbringing that I had in the kitchen, and I was very much a product of my surroundings, you know. So I came out of there.
How important was the waterside in for your development, though, as a chef moving forward?
Look, I wouldn't change the time I had for the world, you know, like the standards that are there. There was only three Michelin star restaurants in the country. There was Ramsay's in London, Gordon Ramsay, Royal Hospital Road, and then the Waterside Inn and the Fat Duck, and they were both in Bray, this tiny little village, which had two pubs and two restaurants. Heston owned both the pubs and one of the restaurants, and then there was the Waterside. So there wasn't even a post office in the village, you know. So it was amazing. Like I learned so much there, and I'm so thankful for my time that I had there. First time I met Michel Roux, I sort of elbowed him in the chest because he snuck up behind me, and I thought it was someone mucking around, and turned around and was like, "Oh, sorry, chef, how are you going?" Blah blah blah. So, yeah, it was fun. But yeah, like I said, it was a tough kitchen. On my first week there, it's the type of place where people would go out for lunch or go for their split. If you're lucky enough to get a split and not come back, you know, either the knives will be there. They're just Houdini on you. So two of the chefs on my first day said they were going for doctor's appointments, and the sous chef went, "Looks like it's just me and you on the veg section," you know. And that was Michael Nizzaro, my first day in a three Michelin star kitchen. He's like, "You okay?" I went, "Yeah, no worries. We'll show me what to do and I'll do it." So he brought it up a fair while. He went on and he's won his own Michelin star in Bath Priory and achieved some great things as well. But yeah, it was an institution, you know. It's one of those things. Like my lecturers at college both worked underneath chefs that had worked for Escoffier. So my sort of heritage is all the way from Escoffier, Roux Brothers, which are sort of like the most influential chefs in England from the 60s onwards, sort of thing. They're the ones that trained up Ramsay, they've trained up Marco, anyone sort of went through those kitchens, you know, and did their time.
What led to the move to Australia?
One of my friends who I met at the Waterside, actually, he'd gone on to Greece and done his sort of homage to Greece and worked there, Alexis, and he was on his way back to Oz and said, "Do you want to come over and see what it's like?" You know, so I jumped on a plane 11 years ago and been here ever since. Settled in Melbourne for 2 years first. We helped open up a restaurant called Hobba, which was in Paran. That was a monster of a restaurant, a cafe. Even we were we'd have six A4 pages of back to front of waiting lists each day on a weekend. So it just, you'd look out to the left. It was a double garage, 90 seater, or a triple garage on Paran. It used to be a mechanics. You look over outside and it just looked like a zombie apocalypse of people just waiting to come in and sit down and eat, you know. The ticket machine wouldn't stop going from when you opened the door till 4 o'clock. We'd stay there on bread crates because it was me, Josh, who was the exec chef, a friend of mine from training at the gym. I was doing jiu-jitsu back in those days, and he was a number plate puncher and a foreign student who didn't speak English, one of my best mates now, called Wellington. We were staying there with milk crates, because even though we were only open breakfast and lunch, we were prepping as much in-house as we could. We were making the burger buns, all of that, like the baked beans, all of that sort of style. At triple cooked chips on the first day, soon sort of realized the error in our ways there. But we were doing a lot, because he had worked at the Fat Duck in England, and I only just stumbled across him from an ad on Gumtree, I think, when I was doing my backpacking bit. So that was intense, though. I didn't have a day off for about 3 months, and like I said, we were sleeping there and doing whatever needed to be done. And like, we were doing 10,000 eggs a week from the first week. We were doing the slow poach, 62.5 degree eggs, and sort of changing a little bit of what the cafe scene was pretty much a decade ago. So it was interesting.
What was it like for you working in Australia, having dealt with the produce of the UK, particularly game birds, and then coming to Australia with such different ingredients and produce? What was it like for you, the change?
It was interesting. I learnt so much, you know, and you sort of see the different produce, and you just try and associate it. Well, for myself, I was trying to associate it with the stuff that I knew from back home, and tasting it and seeing if the techniques that I knew could make something great out of this ingredient that I hadn't seen before, you know? So it was a fantastic to be exposed to all of those new sort of Asian influence as well, which wasn't too big growing up back home. Like, I mean, in England, Asian's Indian, you know? So that's sort of my association. Then you come over here and you go, oh, okay, there's a lot of other ingredients, and I suppose I was a bit naive before I got over here, you know. I'd never really seen much else. I'd always done the fine dining and very classical French. I wanted to – it was great, and I'd gone from doing that sort of 80 to 100 hours a week to the cafe scene. I just felt like a change. I went for jobs at Attica, I went for jobs at Vieux du Monde, got offered positions everywhere that I went, but I just needed a bit of a break, you know. And the cafe scene over here was fantastic. You're making whatever, like, everything in-house, a lot of chefs that have gone out of the fine dining. It wasn't like back home. Back home, you say you're working in a cafe and they think you're doing a greasy spoon with bacon, eggs, full English, fried bread, and it's completely different. It's relaxed dining. The Three Blue Ducks have been open for a couple of years, so they were kind of like your pioneers in that casual dining from Tetsuya's, and changing what the industry was and what you had to do to sort of survive in it, you know.
Well, your detour from fine dining is quite fascinating. You created a peanut butter company. You've made your own bacon, worked with a coffee company. It's been a real detour. Tell us why that happened and what it was like getting away from that old school training that you had had.
Look, it was tricky. When I first came over, I worked at a little cafe in Sandringham in Melbourne, and it was really difficult making that transition. And I've had a lot of chefs come over to travel and said, oh, look, just have a little break, go in a cafe, and they can't do it. They can't prep and cook at the same time. For me, it was – I'd done kickboxing when I was 17, and when you're working that much, you don't have time to do any training. So I'd sort of let myself go a bit, and I wanted to get back into training and doing martial arts. And I found a gym in Melbourne, which was fantastic, doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu and MMA and that kind of stuff. So I sort of sunk myself into there. So I finish work at 3, come home, and then I train every night and spend 2-3 hours training, learning different skills. And for me, it just kind of – I think if I'd gone to Attica or Vieux du Monde, I would have got homesick very quickly. whereas I was able to build a network within food and outside of food, and it just it allowed me to fall in love again, you know, and really enjoy it and take it back. The hierarchy, love the hierarchy, but again, like I said, it was always being a self-starter, so I wasn't really good at people telling me what to do, how to do this next. As much as it is nice to switch off, I always felt like there was a different way to organize your time and manage your time management. So to jump off of the Waterside Inn and go to a cafe is obviously a very big sidestep or a very big step back, depending on which way you want to look at it. But like you said, I was able to craft a different career path where I'm not working, you know, 80, 90, 100 hours a week to cook for an ego or cook for whatever you want to say, cook for myself. I was able to create that work-life balance. I was a private chef for the past 3 years as well, so I was kind of working 12 till 8, which was fantastic because we had a newborn when I started there. He's now three and a half. So I was able to spend the morning with him. I was able to put him to bed at night, and it was amazing. I wouldn't have given that time back for the world, you know, and I could not have done that if I was doing your conventional restaurant shifts. So for me, I grew up with my dad's an antiques dealer. I grew up with him around a lot, and I wanted to make sure that I had that for my son. So being able to do the peanut butter, I was at Single Origin Roasters for 3 years. They sponsored me, and they had a peanut butter mill there. So I don't really like peanut butter. So it is, and it's funny, like I don't really like the plain peanut butter, but I came up with a recipe which was almonds, peanuts, honey, salt, and a neutral oil. And it got that balance just where it's sweet, salty, the almonds cut through the peanutiness. So it's a bit more balanced, you know. And while I was at Single O, we were making our own bacon. I was doing nitrate-free bacon using feather and bones, pork neck, because it was a cheaper cut. So I was able to use, like, the best meat that I could get hold of and make the bacon there. So I was doing nitrate-free bacon, which doesn't stay pink, and it tastes more like a seasoned pork. So after we had opened up Botany for Single O, and we were sort of getting in the way, getting ready to open up the city store, I kind of went, you know what, I need to go back home, do my 3 months at home, come back over and go from there. So I went back home and worked in a traditional smoker for 3 months that had been going since the 1990s and learned how to make bacon. Did the smoked salmon there and all of those different cured and smoked products, you know, and wanted to come back and have a go at doing it properly. So we were doing a market stand with our dry cured and cold smoked bacon as a bacon and egg roll, you know, and we were doing the slow poached eggs that you were frying. So it looks a bit like a scallop and, lots of different stuff.
What sort of impact has that fine dining background and that move to more casual and also retail products, what sort of impact has that had on what you're doing at Berrimah Vault House?
With the retail products at the moment, because this is a new startup, it's been going since the 1st of May, I've kind of put those on the back burner at the moment, just because I need to focus all my attention down there, really. But look, it's been fantastic. It's been fantastic. Like I was able to get those launched while I was doing the less hours doing the private work, and then I've been able to put those on hold. They're ticking over gently. Like my wife's or Jessica Pedermont, who's got the chocolate shop, Chocolate Artisan in Haberfield. So she's retailing them from there. We've got a couple of other retail stores across Sydney as well that are taking it. But I've just got to let that maintain itself at the moment while I get Berrimah set up. Obviously, that's a bit of a drive away for me as well. It's about an hour and a half, so the commute is pretty decent. And there's not many staff at the moment, especially in rural towns. So we're kind of I'm really keen to get the 4-day working weeks happening for the staff when we do get enough. It's what the way the industry is moving, you know, it's not about getting the 100-hour weeks anymore and trying to progress. Like, if you look back, you go, well, I've done 2.5 worth of work per week. So you learn a lot in that time, you know. Whereas now it's, I think with the nurturing and being able to do those 40 hours a week, you get a lot more focus out of your team. And especially if they can get their 3 days off, they're just not exhausted. They're not running on adrenaline and fumes, and it's a lot easier to navigate, you know.
You mentioned that Berrimah Vault House is in a building from the 1840s. Tell us a bit about the building and the restaurant.
Yeah, so it used to be a blacksmith's back in the day, and it's just over the road from the old jail. So it's got a couple of holding cells, which are now private dining rooms. And there's apparently a tunnel that tunnels from the cells at the vault house to the jail, and it's where they used to sneak in contraband and black market stuff and professionals of the night. Wow. So it's got a lot of history there, you know. So I went over there to check it out. Simon got in contact with me and it started off as a consulting job. I was just going to get the menu set up and all the recipes sorted out and do an ongoing gig, and now it's progressed to executive chef. So I'm quite happy to make the change. It's nice to sort of be back out there in the restaurant scene and getting a bit more industry currency, you know. I feel like I'm in a position mentally where I'm ready to get out there and sort of show Australia a bit of what I do, what I've kind of spent my life working towards and learning. So look, the restaurant's fantastic. They've kind of done a whole refurb over the whole place, but they've kept a lot of the original features. Like, we got the largest fireplace in the Southern Highlands, which is fantastic. It's beautiful. But they've put some modern twists in as well, you know, which is kind of the direction that we're going with that food. You've got that familiarity, and then you've got just something a little bit different. Like, we're doing a Bloody Mary foam on top of the prawn cocktail, for instance, and that kind of style. So you just get that little hint of spiciness that comes through. So it fits in well. As soon as I saw the building when it was in production stage, I fell in love. It just reminded me of Gravesite. It reminded me of the buildings that I knew growing up, and I could just see the style of food that I wanted to do. You know, it's for me, it's everyday food. It's homely food that you can eat every day, but everything's done with those proper techniques that I've learned throughout my career. Flavors first. There's no point in having a food that looks fantastic. You spend 20 minutes putting little flowers on with tweezers, and by the time the customer gets it, it's cold, you know, and there's no substance there. It's all a lot of style over substance. Whereas for me now, it's like, let's make decent, hearty food full of flavour and still make it look nice, present it simply and go from there.
The last year and a half has been challenging for many, but what's some of the positives that have come out of this experience for you?
Look, for me, it's a bit different. I was very fortunate because I was doing the private work, so I didn't really lose much, I suppose, income or business during that time. Unfortunately, I lost a couple of clients from my consulting, but always when there's huge shakeup and there's huge turmoil, there's always going to be innovations that come out at the end, you know. So it's for me, it's a great opportunity for the industry to reinvent itself. Like I said, you don't have to do those 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 hours a week to get the results. And people realize how fragile the hospitality industry was with the amount of places that did have to close because there wasn't a a slush fund that the business owners could dip into, you know. So I think it's going to be great if we can navigate coming out of COVID. Obviously, it's going to take a few years, but if we can navigate that right, educate our customers about the real cost of food, the real cost of the rent, the wages, giving staff a living wage so they don't have to have another job. They can have that work-life balance, spend time with their kids, and grow as people. You know, you've got to invest in your staff. And that's part of what we're going to do as we're moving forward. It's sort of baby steps, you know. You start by paying them a living wage, giving them that time, making sure they're not doing more than their sort of 38 hours. And then building and growing from there. Like the industry's so far behind most others. And it's a perfect opportunity to come out the other side and go, look, we're not racing our competition to get the prices as low as we can get and to the bottom and do quantity over quality. We're going, this is a quality product. We're using local suppliers. We're using good staff that we're paying properly and we're investing in. And this is the cost that it is to get your food on the plate.
Well, Tommy, it's wonderful to see you taking people on a nostalgic trip through your food. We've loved having you on Deep in the Weeds today to hear your story. Good luck with Burma Vault House and keep in touch and we'll catch up again soon.
Fantastic. Thanks, Hugs. Thanks for having me.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector.
Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen. Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.